The High Noon Saloon presents Natty Nation's Almost 420 Reggae Party on Saturday, April 19th at 7 p.m. Natty Nation blends authentic reggae with elements of rock, soul, and funk to create a unique Midwestern sound. Natty are joined by Czar, a genre-bending collective that blends the sounds of psychedelic rock with groovy, rhythmic soul and funk, along with your hosts, DJs Trichome and VPS. More information can be found at high-noon.com. The High Noon Saloon presents Natty Nation's Almost 420 Reggae Party with special guests Czar and hosted by DJs Trichome and VPS on Saturday, April 19th at 7 p.m. at the High Noon Saloon. Live music lives at WORT Madison.
الإيربك ويسيل اللي بدأ يلاعب القط بدأ يلقى خرميشو
Translation: If you play with a cat, you can expect to get scratched.
Trust me, my friend, I know. We had a kitten once who enjoyed the claws.
Yes.
And this is not about the cat, and it's not about you. It's about a situation that you put yourself in. And therefore, you must thus withstand.
This is kind of like you should have known
you
what you were getting into.
Yeah, you asked for it. Just
Don't be surprised.
Don't whine about it. Just live with the consequences of you.
Yeah, the fan is running. Don't stick your fingers in that.
Yeah, so you got to bear.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, you got to bear the consequences of said decisions. You know, if you hang out with shady people, you might end up becoming shady. Pretty soon, before you know it, you're standing on the corner selling, I don't know, contraband, highly taxed items from Vietnam.
So is this
shoes?
Is this kind of like, is this specific to staying away from shady characters, or is that just one application for this?
Well, it was used last week when someone came to me complaining about the subsequent pain of muscles because they're now lifting weights.
And would this be one of your offspring, perhaps?
Yes. One of my offspring said, my arms hurt, my shoulders. And I said, I hope you're stretching and warming up. Besides, those weights are heavy.
I'm sorry, Bubba. I can't put the salt in the water softener. I can't lift my arms that high.
It's too heavy.
Right.
Yes.
But and I can't push the lawnmower either.
But during the sessions at the weight in the weight room, he seems to be just fine curling those 40-pound weapons. Also known as dumbbells. I call them weapons because I fear they're going to fall on my toes. And the other day I came up with a concept that was unique. One of my kids rolled his eyes. I said, why don't they make them out of aluminum? Aluminum is much lighter metal. And the smarter of the two says, but that defeats the purpose, Dad. Oh, I see. I thought maybe there's
maybe a little psychological, bit. Maybe a little bit, right?
Psychological effect from lifting a dumbbell that weighs 2 ounces, but it looks like it's 20 pounds versus, you know, hollow aluminum.
Aluminum cans
weigh nothing. So you can make dumbbells that look very heavy.
Or you could just make them out of plastic.
But sure. Yeah,
sure.
That works too. But I thought, you know, I was just comparing the steel, iron, cast iron to aluminum being a lighter metal. But, you know, now that you mentioned plastic, I think carbon fiber would be much better.
Definitely, you know, lightweight and strong.
Before we started talking about weights, what is this program going on here?
Ladies and gentlemen, you are once again listening to another installment of Salamat, your weekly tour of Arab and Arab American news, culture, issues, art, music, food, film.
Cats.
And cats.
And film, yeah.
And yes. Yeah, we actually have some film-related material for you today.
That's Rowan Atala, translator extraordinaire. We promise you to not scratch you on today's show.
Scratch.
Yeah, because the cat, the whole,
right.
Yeah, so yeah. We promise not to be...
Yeah, claws don't work over the radio anymore. Right.
Yeah, right, unless you make not that much. Sound on the desk. On this beautiful, I want to say beautiful today because it's beautiful.
It really is.
A beautiful day. The 6th day of April, 2025, also known as the 8th day of Shawwal, in the year 1446 after Hijra in the Islamic calendar. And by the way, last week we reported on Eid. Eid was celebrated as, you know, the first day of Ramadan. Mm-hmm. I mean, the last day of Ramadan was officially celebrated Saturday.
Right.
And then Eid was Sunday.
Right.
But two countries had declared it the following Monday. So somebody said, how is that possible? Saudi Arabia and Syria did not celebrate the Eid until Monday.
Syria? So, okay. They have their own spotters? Or were they just following the Saudi guidance?
Yeah, it's often a political scene related to the people that whom we identify.
Right.
Have an affinity for in the region, and we declare it with them.
So who had the spotter that declared it to be on Saturday? What country was that?
Saudi Arabia and Syria followed suit. I was talking to relatives.
That was
there.
Sunday. So you said they celebrated Eid on Monday.
No, on Monday, yeah. So the last day of Ramadan was extended to include Sunday. Where here in North America, we sighted the moon before sunset the previous day.
So that was specifically a spotter in the U.S.?
The United States,
okay.
Particularly the Islamic Society of North America, which are the people that I personally follow, mm-hmm. Had said on Friday that Saturday would be the last day of the lunar cycle, thus mm-hmm. creating the last day of Ramadan. So now some people's calendar may say the 7th of Shawwal, ours says the 8th of Shawwal, and that's why I wanted to mention that to our listener.
So we do have a little bit of a special presentation today.
We want to celebrate Wisconsin Film Festival, particularly mm-hmm. the few films that have been somehow, including the Arab American or the Arab perspective. This one is shot in Israel, Haifa, my hometown. I had the pleasure to work with the director, Mr. Qabti Idris. And they aired, the film already showed one time yesterday, so mm-hmm. but it's playing again. You have the calendar in front of you. It's playing again Thursday in Madison, Wisconsin. We hope this interview brings you closer to the director/producer/. He was a jack of all trades, including other family members. So do you want to just let it roll, and then we'll come back and briefly talk about the artiste behind the vision and say why he was selected or why he chose to create such a work of art.
Right. So this is a conversation that you had with the director, right?
Yes.
That was okay. So and the showing of this film that is upcoming is Thursday, April 10th. It is at noon, and it is going to be at Flick's Brewhouse in Madison.
An intimate showing. Well, I would assume the brew house can't really seat thousands of people.
All right. So, and this is a conversation that Sabi had with the director on, it was on Friday, right?
Friday. Yep.
All right. So let's give this a listen.
Tell me, who are the Qabti family involved in here? I see three names. Iskandar is one of the trilogy. Who are the other two?
So the other two are my little brothers, Tony Ujirias.
Yes.
They are my producers. They've been producing basically all the stuff I've done, whether it's films or visual arts, since forever.
Little baby brothers stepped up to the plate and took care of business.
Yeah. I actually dragged them. We all come from a family of engineers, including my older brother. He actually acts in a film. He has a tiny little role in the film.
Nice.
And somehow I dragged them to the film industry.
Most of these people are not known actors. but you were able to get them to the level of proficiency to do what they did really well. It was easily discernible that they've got either plenty of training or they're just natural artistes, especially the role of Omrami. Omrami reminded me of my mother. It does appear that you have very talented people. If it's natural talent, how were you able to handpick some of the individuals that portrayed these complicated roles? I mean, there's so much underlayment, that, if I may use the term, that they had to perfect these subtle nuances. And I can imagine that some of these scenes, a single 15, 20-second scene may have taken a couple days to shoot, unless they were really, really that good. So tell me more about the recruiting for the film.
So basically, these are non-actors. Mm-hmm. These are not professional actors. These are people that come from the background of their profession in the film. So Dr. Waleed is a real doctor. Mm-hmm. He was in internal medicine. Now he transitions to endocrinology. So the nurse, Miri, is a real nurse, and this is what she does. She does allergy tests and so on. Everybody in the film, even the tiny role of the real estate agent, comes done by a real estate agent. Now, I work usually also in Happy Holidays, and in my first film, Ajami, I work in this method that relies heavily on our ability, our innate ability to respond with real emotions to fiction, right? Mm-hmm. It's called the paradox of fiction. Mm-hmm. It has many, many names. And this innate ability allows us basically to react emotionally to a film that we watch, knowing cognitively that the film is not real. We know it's not real blood. We know that she didn't really leave him, but still we cry. Mm-hmm. Still we feel happiness, sadness, mm-hmm. and so on. Mm-hmm. So instead of creating this dynamic between a person and the screen, I created within a scene. None of those non-actors ever received a screenplay. They don't have a clue what the film is about. They just trust me. I work with them prior to the shooting, train them how to improvise, basically bringing them back to the point that they were before I started, you know, shooting in a camera. You know, because this fear of failure destroys our ability to be raw and authentic. Mm-hmm. And then I basically shoot the whole film chronologically with two cameras, no blocking, no film lights, not even a boom microphone. Everybody's mic'd. So it's real life. You know, nobody asked the mother to be angry here or to be sad here. They react to what is happening. And obviously, I choose them based on how similar they are, you know, in terms of personality, not story, to the characters I've written. I usually choose people that come from the opposite background. So let's say, you know, Dr. Ruti, you watch the film, who does a horrible racist thing. She's an incredible, you know, pro-Palestinian activist. She risks her life going to demonstrations in the West Bank. And I told her, like, listen, I need you for a mission. And it's acting a role of a monster, you know, mm-hmm. of a racist monster, mm-hmm. and so on and so on. So this is how it works. And it's magical. So, you know, if a 15-second scene could, you know, take, you know, I don't know, an hour of rolling. We don't stop shooting. It's mm-hmm. just like a documentary. And then, you know, I edit my own film. So I ended up with almost 180, 190 hours of footage, and I had to cut it down to 2 hours.
A challenge at best. My favorite scene that felt very non-improvised reminded me of the scene in our kitchen when mom and aunts and siblings and granddaughters and all the ladies are cooking. And that scene was so real to me. I'm thinking that this had to have been either... You didn't tell them that their cameras pointing at some faces and the reaction between. But anyway, I don't want to spoil the film for our viewers. But thank you so much for telling us about who the Qibti family is involved in this family project. The production may have cost you a couple million dollars. I saw some of the names of the funders. It looks like you got some international funding, some from the Middle East, some from Europe, some from the other places in the world. How were you able to, relatively quickly, tell me, how challenging was it to get funding for such a project that may end up exposing you and the donor or the funder or the financier behind it, possibly touching an issue that's been relatively taboo? You know, like in the U.S., black and white creates fiction in Israel. Arab Israeli creates that fiction.
I mean, it's difficult anyways to get funding for films, but as a Palestinian, I'm eligible to European funds, and these are public funds. And the way they work is that you apply for a screenplay, they have committees of readers that eventually decide to give or not to give money. We were lucky that we managed to get funds from Italy, Germany, France, and also Eurimage, which is a European fund that belongs to EU, and also funds from the Arab world, like the Doha Film Institute, which supports mainly Arab cinema, and also AFAQ, which supports only Arab arts in general and cultural projects. So they supported us. And then, you know how you make films with public funding.
Any funding from your pockets? Any of your own? It may end up being that way.
Yes. Usually, you defer your salary. I'm a director, an editor, and a screenwriter. So, yeah, I didn't get money for that. So I invested this money in the film. It's getting harder and harder to make films. I guess it has to do with, streaming platforms. Most filmmakers are going towards TV series, which are super interesting, obviously. But some of us still wish to make like a 2-hour film, and that's it.
Could this be morphed into a series of Netflix, possibly?
I mean, I think that's it. This film is done, It's okay. This is what I did, and it's done, and it's out, and I don't owe it anymore. It's for the public to watch it, to debate it, and to decide if they like it or not. Yeah, I don't know what the future brings.
Well, what I saw, this is just me, the film, and I'm not a connoisseur, but I appreciate a piece of artwork, especially if it has something from real life. And to me, there was elements of real life in it. And I saw that you're not ashamed of, or you didn't shy away from including in a seamless way the systemic discrimination, or I want to call it racism, because in some cases it was ethnic related, in some cases it was social, and in some cases it was socioeconomic. The money plays a role in those separations. Race plays a role in that separation. The ethnic background plays a role in that separation. You were able to somehow include it in there in a way that was, in some cases, according to me, it was underplayed. Like, I could have easily highlighted more of whatever I felt was more moving to me as a viewer. So you were able to seamlessly include these things in what I call the tapestry of ins and outs. There are a few stories dancing back and forth, braided. Almost you're braiding these stories together into a nice strand that, in my opinion, could have had more featured in one way or another. How did you deal with these issues in such a short time? Because this could have been a 5-hour movie, but you were able to do that. And you said there was no script written for any of this stuff.
No, there was a script that I've written, but I never shared it with anyone other with my two camera people and my producers. But to answer your question, I think the film deals with decisions and morality, and what it means. And this whole idea that some people perceive themselves as having a superior morality. You called it racism. I call it moral supremacy. And we ask ourselves, going historically, all the horrible things that happened to us, to mankind, has to do with this. I'm talking about crusaders. I'm talking about 400 years of slavery. You cannot blame all white. You cannot say all those white people that enslaved black people are horrible human beings. They didn't perceive themselves as horrible human beings. They perceived themselves as superior than Africans, right? And I think all of our problems, including the genocide now in Gaza, has to do with this, has to do with this idea that some morality is superior than others. And you see it, 15 medics were butchered a few days ago, their bodies buried, their ambulances buried, and the West is
very quiet.
Very, very quiet. And it only has to do with the value of those people that died, but even more, the morality of those that choose not to talk about this. So I think my film is about this. I don't deal with things, as you said, they're very subtle, they're not on the nose, and I'm very aware of this, and I do it intentionally because I'm not a rock star. I don't make my films for people that follow me and they want to watch my next film. No, I'm a nobody. In fact, I make films for people that would not like probably what I'm talking about. So I have to figure out a way not to create resistance within my audience. So this is why none of my characters is an antagonist. None of them are bad. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the mother, Umrami.
Yeah.
She does a horrible thing. And for some Fifi, you know, her daughter mm-hmm. has done a horrible thing. But how can you judge her when this structure, you know, you walk a few miles in her shoes, she becomes your protagonist, you fall in love with her, you like her, and then boom, she does something awful. And this creates a cognitive dissonance within you, within the audience, that makes you rethink all those elements that I just talked about.
Now, an artist occasionally will step back from a project they just finished and look at it and would say maybe to oneself, if I get to do this again, I would do X. What do you think now that you step back from the film, you've seen it a few times, and you're beyond the point of going back to the to retweak it. What would you do if I said to you, you know what, I think there might be a couple of things missing. I don't know what they are, but hey, Skander, check this again and let me know what you can do to do X. I'm not going to say make it better. I'm just going to say now that you have an opportunity, I'll give you 10 more hours to work on it. What would you do? I know this is a leading question, but would you have done anything differently today that you see the film that you couldn't have back then?
Let me try to answer this by presenting a question that I get from my students. I teach at NYU, New York University, Abu Dhabi. Mm-hmm. And my students, they keep asking me, so when do you stop to edit? When do you say, okay, this is it? That's it, you know? And then I say, when you're exhausted.
That's the million-dollar question.
And you accept it. At this stage, I think all artists, not only filmmakers, develop this like self-defense mechanism that wouldn't allow them to ask themselves this question, because this could be super depressing. This could be a death sentence to any artist, regretting something they've done and saying like, oh my God, I wish I could go back in time. I wish I had 10 more minutes. And I think this is part of what we develop, you know, to protect ourselves. I'm too exhausted to go back. Even if given 10 hours by you, I would say, oh, thank you. I'm tired. I just want to move on to the next project.
We thank you so much for taking the time to discuss this with us here on WRT. And Selamat, is honored to have had you on the air today to discuss the movie, the film, which is still airing in Madison, Wisconsin. Skander Qapti, thank you so much, and continued success to you, friend, in all of your endeavors.
Happy holidays.
فرصة سعيدة تعرفنا عليك بخير. يعطيك العافية والقوة إن شاء الله. مع ألف سلامة.
الله يسلمك. سلام.
And that was Sabi speaking with Skander Qapti, the director of Happy Holidays, which is playing as part of the Wisconsin Film Festival. And again, that next showing is this coming Thursday, April 10th, at noon at Flix Brewhouse in Madison. It's at 85 East Town Way. We do have a couple of other quick community calendar events to announce. One of those, this is also taking place Thursday, April 10th. The UW Middle East Studies program is having their annual program conference called the Global Middle East. This is from 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Memorial Union on the UW-Madison campus. It is free and open to the public. And then just a hair further out on the calendar, April 12th, this is next Saturday, the Anti-War Cafe, featuring open mic and small group discussions with Stefania Sani on war tax resistance and John Peck on previous divestment struggles at UW-Madison, including those at South Africa, Burma, Sudan, etc., and leading up to today. So this is, it is a monthly gathering, but this next one is April 12th, noon to 3 p.m. at The Crossing on UW campus at 1127 University Avenue.
Quick local story. Governor Whitmer of Michigan declared April as Arab American Heritage Month in the state of Michigan. Trump ignores it nationally, according to this article. Last Tuesday, for the fifth consecutive year, Governor Whitmer announced it. Says this month is recognized as Arab American Heritage Month in the state. The state of Michigan houses the most, as a percentage of population, the most densely Arab area in the U.S. According to census somewhere. It wasn't me. I didn't go counting.
Right, heads.
Okay, with a show of hands, who's an Arab? Did I sound like Yosemite Sam? You know, he's often angry.
Not quite. You have to use the word varmint.
In stark contrast, according to this article, President Trump has refrained from officially recognizing the occasion at the national level, despite previously acknowledged by the importance of Arab and Arab Muslims here, especially for his electoral victory, particularly in Michigan. On the other hand, former President Biden became the first president to recognize Arab American Heritage Month back in 2022. So according to Whitmer, Arab Americans made valuable contributions to nearly every aspect of American society for over a century, including in medicine, law, beeswax, education, technology, government, military service, and culture.
Yes.
It's nice to be recognized.
It is.
As long as that recognition doesn't become a tool for them to discriminate against you. Watch out there, Rowan.
Do you think that could happen?
Hey, suddenly, you know, before you start waving the victory sign, you might just come up there and revoke your birth certificate.
It could happen.
I hope not.
Well, yes. Initially.
I will defend you. As soon as I see someone coming with a gun, I am no longer associated with you. I know nothing.
Thank you. That's a very robust defense, and I appreciate that.
As long as there are no guns involved.
So last week, we had reported on 60 colleges across the U.S. receiving letters from the Congressional Committee on Education and Workforce expressing concern over incidents of what they described as anti-Semitism. Although in the body of the letter, they do explicitly define anti-Semitism as including criticism of Israel or even criticism of Zionism. At Wednesday of this week, religious leaders, human rights activists, and others urged Wayne State University officials to protect students who are supporting Palestinian rights. So those letters that were mailed out expressing concerns mm-hmm. were also explicitly demanding correspondence between university administrations and student protesters. So there's a lot of concerns
loaded,
there for the students.
Mm-hmm.
So this past Wednesday, a bunch of religious leaders and human rights activists sent an open letter to Wayne State University President Kimberly Andrews Espy and members of the university's Board of Governors expressing deep concern over what they describe as repressive campaigns targeting students protesting acts of genocide in the Palestinian-occupied territories over the last year. And these are campaigns that have notably escalated in recent weeks since the occupation decided they were done with the ceasefire. So it's good to see a little support from the community. I have to say, I hope the university administrations, plural, will take these students' concerns and their privacy concerns very, very seriously and do their utmost to protect the students from government scrutiny and interference.
Any support for Palestinians is considered support for terrorism and is considered as a reason to deport someone, revoke their student visa or any kind of visa, and ship them back home.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, my gosh. We are about out of time.
How'd that happen?
Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to another episode of Salamat, your weekly tour of Arab and Arab American news, culture, issues, art, music. Yes, we are going to play a little bit of music. We don't really have time to describe it, so maybe we'll do that next week, shall we?
Also, the food segment is on the back burner. Pun intended.
Right. Yes. Understood. Stay tuned for the Pachyderm Parade coming up next here on WORT 89.9 FM. In the meantime, we will bid you farewell by saying, as always, in Arabic,
Habibi, masalame. That was a Syrian dialect.
As always.
As always. Yo, 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 what up? Habibi. Later.
All right. We will say farewell with that, and please join us again next week. In the meantime, Pachyderm Parade coming up very shortly.
The 2025 Wisconsin Film Festival is going on now, all over Madison until April 10th. There are over 170 films of all shapes and sizes for you to choose from. This includes some of the best cinema from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. Choose from comedies, dramas, experimental, animated, and student films, as well as